my son was scheduled to be here with me. Can you hear me in the back? He's not here because he is hopefully selling about a ton and a half of tomatoes at the Lexington Farmers Market today. So I'm going to, we had a freeze 2 weeks ago. We picked our tomatoes beforehand, and then we discovered after the freeze that there were still a lot to be picked. The foliage was dead, but the tomatoes were not all damaged. And then just day before yesterday, I went out and picked a few, which I brought with me just to give you some indication of what we're about with tomatoes. And then the remainder of my talk will be about beans. This is the German yellow, also known as pineapple, big rainbow, Georgia streak, hillbilly, Kentucky beefsteak, and Mr. Strappy. Probably a half dozen to a dozen other names, and I've got at least seven family heirlooms like this that are known by the family that I got the seed from. We grow about 150 varieties of beans each summer, of which at least 100 are heirlooms. I have nothing against the other type of tomatoes. Did I say beans a minute ago? I meant tomatoes. For about 130-some varieties of beans. But I want to explain a little bit of something about this. I want to pass these around in a few minutes, and if some of you want to keep them at the end of my presentation and take them home and use them for seed, you may do so. I don't intend to take these back. However, I do intend to take my beans back because in some cases, I don't have enough to share yet. I'll put out the ones that I do have to share, and you can take them, but some I just grew for the first time this year. But this damage right here was done by the cold weather, and if this was selling in Lexington today, this one would go for $1 a pound because it has one bad spot. This one would go for 50 cents a pound because it's got a significant bad spot on it. This one, which is considered a white tomato, would go for $1.20 a pound. We have three prices right now, $1.20, $1, and 50 cents, depending on the damage. None of these would grade U.S. number one right now. None of the heirlooms hardly ever would. This is considered a white tomato. It's called Hughes, H-U-G-H-S. These are Brandywine, which has won all of the Taste Awards. This one, $1 a pound. This one, $1.20, because it's in pretty good shape. This is Cherokee Purple, which is essentially black on the inside. These are pepper tomatoes. These are all heirlooms, by the way. Sort of ancient type of Roma tomatoes. This is an ox heart, of which there are many. I have a lot of Russian ox hearts, and the Russian immigrants to Lexington, when they arrive at my tables, they immediately get these. And this is a pepper tomato, a stuffing tomato that's hollow on the inside. Maybe during our second hour today, I will split it open so you can see what I'm talking about here. Tomatoes range all the way from white to black, every color in between. If you all want to pass these around while we're talking. Going to be passed around. I'm not going to pass these other posters around. They're a little bit too unwieldy. But I had a research student this summer from Berea College who worked with us, and she made a PowerPoint presentation yesterday at Berea to finalize her work of the summer. And this is one of the posters that she made that's going to be passed around. We grew 132 varieties of beans this summer. This has 16 of them photographed on there just to give you some samples of what we were doing. So while those are being, excuse me, passed around, I'll tell you a little bit about myself. I grew up on a farm in Haywood County, North Carolina. It was, as we've heard described many times, a subsistence farm. My mother sold butter, but she didn't get to sell the eggs because my father sold the eggs, because that was what we did to trade for all of everything else. We typically kept about 100 hens, and he went into town every Saturday to do his trading. I never heard either of my parents say shopping. That was a word that was not in our vocabulary. They were traded. They were traded for everything else that we needed, including there were three of us children at the time that we did most of this. Two came later. But each time he would bring 10 pieces of candy home as well, three for each of the children and one for my mother. Penny candy, and you could get quite a bit for a penny at that time. I'll tell you a little bit more about my mother later. She was the one who got me involved in all of this. Well, I'll go ahead and say to you now that I had two younger sisters, a sister 2 years younger than I was, and she was not the slightest interested in gardening. Neither was the other sister who came along. She's 18 years younger than I am. She was the youngest in the family. Neither one of them showed any interest in gardening at all, and I did. My first memory is in a garden when I was 2 years old. My grandfather was trying to show me how to distinguish between young cockleburrs and young sweet potatoes when they were young, so I would know which one to cut, which one to leave. And I became addicted to gardening at the age of two. Have been a victim of that addiction since that time. And I'm 65 now, so I've done it for 63 years, almost nonstop. There was one summer when I was managing a swimming pool in Knoxville that I didn't get to put out a garden. But the rest of the time, as soon as I moved back to Berea in 62 to become the director of the student union, I've had a garden. Excuse me, I'm having a little bit of breathing difficulty today, but I think it'll get better as time goes on. I did 4-H and FFA in high school. I had 4-H for my crops and FFA for my animals. I set the North Carolina Corn Growing Championship in 1951 as a 10th grader, which sent me to the National 4-H Club Congress in Chicago and opened up a new world for me, very much so. The first TV set I ever saw, I saw myself on TV because they had it rigged. As we looked at the TV screen, we could see ourselves because of the way it was being, we were being photographed. Of course, that's easier, much easier to do today. And that was in the Museum of Science and Industry in Chicago. I'd never seen one before that. I went to Berea in 1954 to work my way through because I liked the work program. I still like it. I'm about to retire this year after being 40 years on the staff there, 4 years as director of the alumni building and the student union activities, 22 years as an administrator directing projects for troubled youth and high-risk youth, the first Project Torchlight, and then Upward Bound. Some of you may have had some association with an Upward Bound program at some college or university, and then the last since 1988, I've been full-time professor and coach. I coach the swim team. I'm a professor of physical education and general studies. I teach everything from beginning swimming to aquatic art, which is the artistic version of synchronized swimming, and I'll have a course in that in January, my last one this coming January. Typically have about 35 students, and we prepare three performances for the end of the semester, the same performance done three nights running, I should say. And then I teach literature and poetry and mythology, and I taught one course in cults at one time the year after Jonestown. I've long had a fascination with cults, so I do a lot of things. I got my degree in biology from Berea. I stayed an extra year and got an additional degree in physical education. Then I went to graduate school in physical education, ended up with a master's in modern dance, and that I moved out of the water to do that. It was sort of an evolving kind of thing. I was in aquatic art first, and then in the modern dance. I did a lot of the adagio numbers because I was the only male. Some of you apparently know what I'm talking about. Went to the University of Tennessee after 5 years at Berea and two majors, and in specializing in modern dance. The chair of the department, who had a master's degree in math from Ohio State, no training whatever in phys ed, and that showed every day. But he was a good friend of the president of the institution, and he had rewarded him by making him chairman of the department, never mind that he had no experience in it. He called me in one day, and he says, "Mr. Best, you're going to have to leave your major in modern dance." And I asked why, and he says, "I can't have men and women in the same classroom with such a small amount of clothing on." So I went back, leotards, of course. So I went back to see Miss Bowman, who is the chair of the department, and she went back. She said, "Either Mr. Best stays in my department or I leave." So he let me stay, and then he said, "I'll let him stay on one. For one reason, he has to take a course in administration under me." The following quarter, I took administration under him, got an incomplete. That incomplete remained on my record until I left Berea, until I left UT, and went in the Army, came back and taught, and then went back to Berea, and I got a call from the new chair of the department. He said, "Mr. Hobbs is dead." He said, "If you will come down here and have a conversation with me, I will send you home with your degree." So one of the few people ever to have gotten his degree over someone's dead body. And I can say this now. A few years ago, I guess I couldn't tell that story because there were still too many people around who knew it. Anyhow, I ended up back at Berea doing a host of things. I've taught two courses per year, one per semester, in what we call general studies for many years, but I took one course in agriculture my first semester at Berea, decided that I'd had enough already, and I never took another one. I did not want to become a part of the machine that later became what is known as the supermarket for the world. I preferred being a supermarket for a much more localized clientele, and so I took over, at her insistence, my mother's work with heirloom beans. And to be honest, when I first started gardening, after we bought our first farm within a few weeks after we moved to Berea, I ordered my seeds from seed companies. But each time when we would go home at Christmas, my mother would have hers shelled out, and she'd say, "Bill, you really need to keep these going." She never said why. She just said, "You really need to keep these going." And when my mother said, "You need to do it," that means do it. So and she knew by that time that my sister had no interest at all. She had said, "I've had enough poverty." She went to business school. She then moved to Atlanta, where she still lives, in Smyrna. And now that our family land has been divided up, and each of us has about 20 acres, she's finally decided it might be good for her to start gardening, too, at the age of 63 or so. This is what the beans look like. This is a new one to me. This is a Cherokee greasy bean that I didn't shell out. I've shelled the others out. Most of these others have been shelled out just in the past week. I am in the process now of gathering my beans and shelling them out. Then I'll let them dry just a little bit more, and then I will freeze them. But I'm going to pass this around so you can see what they look like before I shell them out. I found that freezing them is certainly the easiest way to preserve them. I've preserved beans for over 20 years. I have two large freezers completely full of beans. I'm getting ready shortly to buy my third large freezer because I've got so many that I don't have enough room, and I don't have any that I want to throw away at this particular point. I'm beginning to share a lot of them. We're on the internet. I got an email from a fellow from Australia the other day. He's from Buncombe County, North Carolina originally, and I have his family bean, and he wanted me to send him a pound of his family beans so that he could start growing them in Australia, where the climate is essentially, where he lives, is essentially the same it was in Buncombe County, North Carolina, including elevation and temperature as well. Okay, I'm going to start passing around these beans, but before I do so, let me tell you just a little bit about them. A greasy bean, does anybody know what a greasy bean is? Has anybody ever heard of a greasy bean? Okay, some of you have. A greasy bean is a bean that doesn't have fuzz on it. We normally don't think of beans as having fuzz on them until you see one that doesn't have fuzz on it, and it's slick. It appears to be greasy. It has nothing to do with preparing it to eat. It's the way it looks. All right, a cut short. Does anybody know what a cut short is? Pardon? More beans per pod, and they are cut short. They are squared off on the ends. So you'll see on some of these, or as speckled, greasy, cut short. A bean can be a cut short, or it can be a greasy, or it can simply be a cornfield bean. And it can be a greasy cut short. But contrary to what you might have read, a greasy bean and a cut short are not the same thing. A greasy bean can be a cut short, and a cut short can be a greasy. However, they are not synonymous terms. A greasy bean has that slick look to it. A cut short is cut off short. And I can look at a bean and I can tell you whether it's a cut short just simply by looking at the seed. So as these get passed around, you will see the term cut short. I want to tell you all just a little bit of the history of some of these. Then we'll pass them around. Beans are typically named after the individual or the family that first started growing them. And I'll tell you how that happened in a minute. This is my Aunt Bertie's bean. It's well over 100 years old. She never separated them. There are three colors of beans in here, a brown, a white, and a black. This is the date bean, which is the longest bean I grow. Have any of you ever heard of the date bean? It used to be fairly common, but now it's distinctly an heirloom. Very long, 12 to 14 inches. Got to save that one for last. This is the tobacco worm bean, so named because it is big and fat and looks like a tobacco worm. Most of you know what a tobacco worm looks like. This is the Big John bean, named after Big John, in Letcher County, Kentucky. And this is what the Big John bean looks like as a dried bean, or a shucky bean, or what we in North Carolina call leather breeches when I was growing up. This is the Lazy Wife bean. And I haven't politically corrected any of these beans. I go by the name as they were given to me. I have at least six varieties of Lazy Wife beans. Originally, most of them were Mennonite beans, as were those tomatoes, those stripy tomatoes, and the Brandywine tomatoes as well. This is a fall bean sent to me by a fellow in Indiana. But he took it with him to Indiana from his home in Letcher County, Kentucky. A fall bean is typically a shell bean, is typically a stringless bean, although they can be eaten with the hulls on. Tennessee cornfield bean. I have very few beans from Tennessee. I think the reason for that is Stokely Van Camp. People gave up their own beans in favor of growing beans for Stokely Van Camp in East Tennessee. In North Carolina and Kentucky, that did not happen. There are probably more heirloom beans in Madison County, North Carolina, than in any other state put together, all of the counties in any other state put together. This is Jack Kelly butter bean. A Cherokee butter bean that comes in two colors right here. This is from the Cherokee Indians as well. A brown tobacco worm bean, which is new to me as of this summer. The Rose family bean, and if you'll see one of these large pictures down here, my hand is in those pictures so you can see the relative size of the bean. The Rose bean is a magnificent bean, big and fat and tasty. Goose bean. When I was growing up, my mother told me the origin of the goose bean. She said that her grandfather had killed a wild goose, and as her grandmother cleaned it, he took out the beans, and here they are. Well, I discovered later that's a worldwide myth. Almost all cultures has its goose bean, and as you know, if you kill a wild goose today, well, somebody answer me real quickly. This is a good deductive reasoning question. What would that bean most likely be? What kind? Well, that's a good point, too. It would be a soybean because of the soybeans planted up and down their flyways. These others are all named after family beans. And you notice that some of these... those around. Now, if you grow as many beans as I do, about 130-some varieties, I don't have an exact count right now because of the deer. They took up some of my beans toward the end of the season, and I haven't counted to see what my losses were. But I have a what I'm calling the Rogue Mountain bean, which is named after a mountain behind my house. This is a mutation that occurred in 1982, and it came from a very short, less than 3-inch long, solid, brown, greasy. And since there were no other beans anywhere near, I figured it had to be a mutation. And I sat on it. Well, it sat in my freezer for 15 years. Then I decided I'm going to have to grow it. I was scared that I would lose it. I sensed that I really had something there, but I was scared that I would lose it. Finally, I planted it, all 61 beans. I decided to take my chance all at once. Unfortunately, we had some damping off occurring, and only 19 survived to maturity. From those 19 beans, we ate one mess and then saved all the rest for seed. The following year, we ate quite a few of them, and I let some other people at the farmer's markets eat them as well. We all agreed that it was an outstanding bean. I then sent some to Park Seed Company and asked them if they'd be interested. They asked for 100 seeds. They really never did respond, except to say that if they were to put it in their catalog, that I would have to provide the seed. And I said, no, I'm willing to give you the bean, license you the bean, but I can't provide the seed. And so we didn't agree, and then I realized that I was probably lucky after that. I hope I never have to do a DNA test to see if my bean has appeared and in some other form, some other name. I don't think it will. I sent it to them because they're a family company, or so I thought, and then I discovered that maybe they're not really any longer a family company. But since that time, I've had another one that I tried out this year, and I think it's coming around, and where I questioned whether it was a cross or a mutation. If I see next year that it's breeding true, then I will have two, and then I will name it after Basin Mountain. There are two mountains behind my home. One is called Rope Mountain, the other Basin Mountain, and so I will name them after those two mountains. I have already named this one the Rope Mountain, and this is what I will continue to do as if I have any more mutations occur. I really don't know how often they occur, but I know that I've seen at least these two that I'm quite sure are mutations. Five more minutes, and let me see what I can I might just leave 5 minutes for questions because I'm gonna start trying to work with the Museum of Appalachia at Norris and let them start selling my seeds. I've got up to 20 pounds of some of my beans now. What I'll do is start selling them at $5 for 100 beans, and I'll pay the postage. That's typical among people who ship out seeds from the seed-saving organizations. I think our organization is the only one in southern Appalachia. And I'm proceeding on that assumption, and I haven't been challenged yet, and I keep collecting, and people still keep sending me their beans. I had 14,000-some hits on our website in August, which I think is rather phenomenal. I even got a call or a letter from a woman in Sweden asking me about Russian heirloom tomatoes. It's the internet is marvelous in terms of doing what the kind of thing that I'm doing now. We're www.heirlooms.org if you want to look it up, and I think our personal addresses are already on your list there. But and all of the stuff that you see in front of you is on the internet if you want to get an up-close and personal look at some of this stuff. Now, some of the other things that I could cover, I will go over in our question and answer series later, dealing with farmers markets and things like this. But let me reiterate, I'm hooked on this stuff, and I've got 6 granddaughters and 2 grandsons, and the granddaughters who are 13 and my oldest sons. I've got 3 children, 2 sons and a daughter, and the oldest 2 have 3 children each, and the youngest has 2 daughters. And it's his 6-year-old daughter, the one who is supposed to be here with me today, is the only one who has shown an interest in what I'm doing. While her 4-year-old sister is playing with her Barbie dolls in the truck by the side of the field, she's out there exploring insects and said, is this this or is this worm that? And she's hooked already. I'm convinced that she's going to follow in my footsteps. And I'm happy to have her, and then I can return my work to the female side of the family, which anthropologists tell me is where it ought to be anyhow. But anyhow, you're stuck with me for right now. Okay. I would encourage you to look at these posters up here during that time if you'd like to. Yes. Do you what now?
How do you dry the seeds?
You let the tomato get rotten. Then you dip them out with a spoon, put them in a strainer, wash water through them, then pick them on some wax paper, then spread them out, individual seeds, let them dry 3 or 4 days later, let them dry at room temperature 3 or 4 days later, scrape them off into an airtight container and freeze them. And I've had plenty of luck keeping them for 20 years that way. Yeah. You call it.
I will.
Well, there are certain. How do I document the beans that come to me? I get beans all the time that I'm asked to investigate and document, and I can't. For the simple reason that these beans have been kept in families, and they have been given family names. But let's put it this way. Of my 130-some, I don't know of any 2 that are alike yet. So once I begin to suspect that some are alike, then I'll probably have the DNA tests run on them to see the difference, if there is a difference. But I can tell the difference in the ones that I have so far. They are certain distinguishing characteristics, especially when they're in the stage of these photographs down here. not as much in the seed. Now, I can't tell some of the seeds apart, but I can certainly tell the beans apart by the color of the bloom, by the shape of the leaf, and certainly by the shape of the bean. I can tell the difference, but I don't know of any commercial bean that resembles any of these. The commercial beans are just unbelievably tough, and maybe we'll get into that in the next session, but I've come to understand from some chefs that in the last few years that beans are no longer considered edible and are simply put on the plates for decoration, and I'll get into that a little bit more in the next session.